thing. No one should long for the good old days of news controlled by the powers of Washington, New York, and Hollywood. Thanks to increased competition, there will be no more sweetheart deals between political power brokers and media titans. You are now much more likely to hear all sides of a story. Sometimes that's more information and more scandal than you might want to hear, but it's your right and your job as a citizen to face up to it. The news choices of today are an important change in your life. They help you decide what kind of country you want. If I'm upbeat about news competition, I'm bored stiff by the entertainment competition. What gives here? We surf through 70 channels and there's nothing interesting to watch? How can this happen? 70 different channels, for crying out loud. For example, my cable system gives me traditional stuff, CBS, NBC, Fox, and ABC with their tired laugh track sitcoms and predictable pulp dramas about cops, lawyers, and doctors. Next come the never-ending news magazines for which I have to take the blame. I admit it. Here's the story. The news magazine explosion started with a whimper in 1989 with Inside Edition, a hybrid of news and entertainment reports anchored by Sir David Frost. Aimed at a blue-collar audience, it emphasized emotional stories and sexy babes. After 3 weeks, Sir David was sacked. The show was tanking. It wasn't exactly his fault. What nut thought this dapper Brit would appeal to the working-class target audience of America? Enter your humble correspondent. Inside Edition producers Bob Young and John Tomlin hired me away from ABC News, and I wound up replacing Frost. The three of us revised the format to include aggressive investigative reporting, my strong suit, and also to sharpen up the entertainment stuff with a punchy point of view. The result? Inside Edition became a monster success in syndication. Well, you know what happened next. The networks jumped in with Dateline, 48 Hours, and so forth. These are often fine programs, but too many clones of Inside Edition send you looking for something else on the box. So here we are, surfing again. Howler monkeys are jumping from tree to tree in Costa Rica, howling away. I can take about 20 seconds of that. Click. I have a choice of 4 sports channels that specialize in bad puns. Some young man in a plaid jacket with a clashing tie winks at me and smirks. Yeah, he could go all the way. Click. I gather that Rhoda and Mary are mad at Lou because... Click. VH1 wants me to understand why one-time teen idol Leif Garrett is depressed. He must be watching cable. Click. Lifetime has brought together a gaggle of women who all hate the fact that men always... Click. MSNBC, Fox News Channel, and CNN are all covering the same tornado in Texas. On all 3 channels, the same fire chief is looking very grim. I sympathize, but... Click. Bill Curtis is investigating some prisons where the prisoners are not very happy. How does Bill find these stories? Click. Elvis is singing the clam in the movie Clam Bake. The words go, do the clam, grab your bashful baby by the hand. Click extra fast. Sipowicz and Simona roughing up some skell. Seen it. Click. HBO has some rough-looking chick riding in the back of a New York taxi, legs splayed apart, telling the driver about her S&M fantasies. He looks confused. He is from Armenia. Click. Bravo features a very grainy movie from Spain. A young shepherd is talking sincerely to his goats. Click. The History Channel, known in the trade as the Hitler Channel, is offering more of its never-ending Nazi footage. Click. MTV offers a program about dating for dumb people. The word awesome is used 8 times in 30 seconds. Click. Garth Brooks. Click. Fake wrestling. Click. Connie Stevens. Help! Why is this happening? In a panic, I run down to the local movie theater. There's got to be something there that's original. I choose Eyes Wide Shut, the final movie of the great director Stanley Kubrick, starring Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. It is bad beyond belief. I am in pain here. I know the same thing is happening to you. Our buddy television is letting us down big time when it comes to entertainment, and things are probably going to get worse. And radio isn't doing much better than TV. Listen to talk radio. Why are most of the successful talk show hosts conservative? Well, it's probably because liberals, whatever you think of their views, are usually non-judgmental. They make exceptions for Ken Starr, Linda Tripp, and Newt Gingrich, but Chinagate? Nah. Buddhist fundraisers? Nah. High taxes? Yawn. Welfare reform? Snore. And conservatives, well, in this country, they get teed off regularly. Liberals can look the other way when Clinton fools around in the Oval Office, but conservatives are outraged. If Find me a conservative who doesn't want to sound off about the collapse of the American way of life or the idea of global warming. Hell, some right-wingers would have to see desert sand dunes in their backyard before they'd cop to that. So if a radio producer can find someone who eggs on conservative listeners to spout off and prods liberals into shouting back, he's got a hit show. After a while, though, the intense verbal action on the right gets predictable and stale. It's not easy for the talk show host to get livid every day, even though they think that Bill and Hillary Clinton are not acceptable. They've got to hope that Al Gore and his Buddhist nuns, his zinc royalties, and his creative memories will take up the slack. If TV is boring and talk radio just recycles the same old ideas, where do we turn? I believe our new best friend is the computer. If you're one of those people who shrink back from the computer, take a deep breath. You have to learn. And it isn't that hard. If a 6-year-old can learn how to go on the internet and download video games and a 9-year-old can produce PowerPoint presentations, don't ask. You can learn how to connect up with the entire world for more information, entertainment, instruction, and conversation with people who share your interests. For now, it's important to know that global media change is in the air. These are the last desperate days for some electronic information outlets. They aren't reacting very well. It's like the lava heading downhill towards Pompeii. Watch closely. There are exciting times ahead. Note to Sue Berman, member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Have to hand it to you, Sue. You've come up with a very original excuse for allowing public drunkenness and drug use to muck up your city streets and ruin things for law-abiding citizens. You argue that the streets are the home of homeless addicts and alcoholics. We can have cocktails in our homes, you say, so they should be allowed to drink or drug themselves into a stupor in their home. What about the other things human beings do in the privacy of their homes, Sue? You want those out in the open, too? Talking point question. Why is there so much drug and alcohol abuse in America today? Simple. Alcohol and drugs make huge profits for legal and illegal organizations. Simple again. The media thrive on the income from beer and liquor ads and haul in dough from you with CDs, movies, books, and TV programs that glamorize the lives of social drinkers, dope heads, and pushers. Simpler still, much of the population is bullish on intoxication. Dedicated pot smokers believe they are mellow and look down on crackheads nodding out in the alleyways. Young professionals sniffing coke know they're masters of the universe. The drug tells them that. The country club set, knocking back martinis, looks down on the rednecks at their noisy beer joint across the county line. And the intellectuals at the local college sneer at both groups for being alkies, but believe that a trip on the latest psychedelic drug is an intellectual adventure. But everyone has one belief in common: I can handle my drug of choice. Talking point. If you're after success in America, substance abuse can be your downfall. Just think of how many mistakes you can make when you're cold sober. When you're inebriated or stoned, your mistake quotient flies to the moon. The more mistakes you make, the tougher your life will be. And your so-called friends have a long memory. Just ask George W. Bush and Al Gore Jr. It's darned hard to get people to listen to your tax cut proposals or your environmental policy when half the country's giggling at jokes on Saturday Night Live, Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien, and David Letterman. Bet you're not feeling groovy now, George and Al. The country's laughing at the next leader of the free world, and that's ridiculous. Viewer timeout. Mr. O'Reilly, how dare you dictate to me what I can ingest, whether it be alcohol or drugs? I'm a consenting adult. I own myself and consider it an assault on my freedom when you and other absolute moralists impose your values on me. I know you're an old fogey, but even old fogies indulge themselves on occasion. That's from Jim F., Toby Hanna, Pennsylvania. Well, you're right about that, Jim. Old fogies do indulge themselves on occasion, but this old fogey tries to do so in moderation and with legal substances and in situations that are not going to involve driving or rifle practice or a sleepover with a girl named Trixie. Here's a basic problem with consuming intoxicants: the child factor. When funny frogs are pushing beer on TV and high-profile actors like Christian Slater and Robert Downey Jr. go into drug rehab, kids learn that something pretty interesting is going on, and they want to try it too. When Woody Harrelson shows up at a movie premiere shoeless but wearing a suit made entirely of hemp, you have to laugh. But this kind of stunt sanitizes the drug issue for kids, and a substantial portion of each generation will lose control and devote their lives to the pursuit of intoxication. Therein lies the problem, and a solution is nowhere in sight. Backup stats. Somewhere between 4 and 6 million Americans are addicted to hard drugs, according to recent government estimates. Another 14 million of us have a constant problem with alcohol. Both drugs and alcohol fuel crime and social problems. No study has ever shown otherwise. More backup stats. In large cities, according to the Office of Drug Control Policy, between 50 and 75% of males arrested test positive for drugs. The percentage is even higher for women. Meantime, the staggering total of tax money spent by local, state, and federal agencies to combat drugs is now about $30 billion a year. And yet, virtually anyone who wants to buy illegal drugs can find them, as the authorities freely admit. Public policy will never put an end to drug addiction. That's why most of the chattering on TV and elsewhere about treatment and legalization and crackdowns is bogus. Intoxication is an extremely personal matter. It can only be dealt with effectively on the individual level. Here's why. It's natural for people to want quick relief from pain, physical or emotional. We want the hurt to stop right now. Drugs and alcohol, unlike some products, do exactly what they're advertised to do. They make you feel good without any effort on your part. Getting drunk or high is easy. It's the lazy, self-indulgent way to escape from the challenges of real life. Despite all the jokes about drink and Irish Americans, I was 16 years old before I was exposed to full-blown intoxication. When a friend's parents left town, he didn't go quite as far as the Tom Cruise character in Risky Business, but he did throw a giant party complete with cases of hard liquor and beer. This was pretty wild stuff in our neighborhood. By the end of the evening, there was serious damage to the house and also to many of the teenage partygoers who either had passed out or were painfully regurgitating. I still don't understand why, but I did not join the drinking. Dr. Pepper in hand, I was a sober observer. To this day, I can see the images of my out-of-control friends. Some of them got goofy, others became hostile, and quite a few acted in ways that none of us ever mentioned again. But my opinion about certain people there that night was forever changed. Before then, I had regarded alcohol as an adult habit, like smoking cigars or going to Vegas. My parents were light drinkers. They didn't drink enough to have mood changes or stumble around the living room. My folks never felt the need to discuss drinking or drugs with me. They didn't have to. My father did not tolerate other kinds of nonsense. I knew that coming home drunk or even tipsy would be extremely risky. For me, drink never had an appeal. But some of my friends took to drugs and alcohol, and the results were not pretty. In our quiet working-class suburb alone, three of my friends were killed by drug abuse. Three other guys in town became addicted to heroin and wound up in jail, and this was Levittown, not Haight-Ashbury or Amsterdam. Was alcohol a less dangerous way to ruin your life? Only in a manner of speaking. More than a few kids in our neighborhood washed out on booze. Their vital signs may indicate they're still alive, but they've chosen a slow form of suicide. Viewer timeout. O'Reilly, what are you, the morality police? Haven't you ever made a mistake? Your position on marijuana is a crock. The best thing you could do would be lay back and stoke one up. Lori B., Seattle, Washington. Well, I've made quite a few mistakes, Lori, no question about that. And if you want to carry your argument about morality police a little further, some people might say that we all have the right to destroy our lives and our careers with drug and alcohol abuse. Why is it any of my business? Well, one good reason is that the abuser is almost certainly going to hurt other people. Something like 75% of all physical abuse against helpless little kids is committed by inebriated adults. That's what the child abuse agencies tell me. Some of these abusers probably thought they would just lay back and stoke one up. But that's only part of the collateral damage of self-indulgent drug and alcohol abuse. Unwanted pregnancies are often the result of drugged or drunken couplings, especially among teenagers. Sexually transmitted diseases, including AIDS, are often passed around and people are too intoxicated to use protection. Alcohol alone is involved in fully half of all murders, accidental deaths, and suicides in the United States, and in almost half of all fatal car accidents, according to the National Institute of Health. Add drugs to the mix, and you can trace most of the social problems we face in America to chemical abuse of some kind. The majority of the pathetic, homeless people living miserably on the streets across the country cannot keep themselves sober. High school dropouts have a high rate of substance abuse, and the list goes on. So why are the few Americans who speak out against drugs labeled morality police, blue noses, or religious zealots? Got me? Since, as I've just demonstrated, substance abuse usually does not take place in a vacuum, and since millions of innocents get hurt or killed, society has to wake up and deal effectively with the problem. It's time for a national outcry. If you don't know it, you should know it. I know it, and the victims of drug abuse know it. But the federal government... not a clue. Backup stats. To stop drugs from getting to your hometown, the feds alone spend $15 billion of your tax dollars every year. Hasn't worked, and it will never work. No matter where you live, I'm willing to bet some zonked out kid could find a drug source within a few miles of your home. And I never bet to lose. How much of the illegal drugs coming to the USA did the DEA, FBI, U.S. Customs, and the Coast Guard combined seize last year? Is what they say themselves. 10%. The home team is losing big. We also send American tax dollars to places like Mexico, Thailand, Colombia, and Turkey so that local authorities will stop the drugs at the source. Does anyone on this earth besides our chuckle-headed politicians actually believe that throwing millions at corrupt officials in underdeveloped countries is an effective program for ending drug trafficking? Ridiculous note. Not long ago, the Clinton administration's comically weak drug czar, General Barry McCaffrey, publicly expressed his admiration for Mexico's top general because the man had taken such a tough stand on drugs. About a month later, this admirable Mexican general was arrested. He had been caught supervising the transshipment of drugs to the USA. Good call, Barry. How about the guys in Colombia? Got any drug war heroes down there? If payments to local authorities and interdiction at the borders don't work, how about the other ideas we hear tossed around all the time? Legalization. I don't think so. When Switzerland legalized drug use in Zurich in the early 90s, I hopped on a plane to check out the program. What I saw turned my stomach. Hundreds of addicts roamed through the bustling center of town, shooting up in plain view of pedestrians, including children. Many of the addicts were filthy and panhandled aggressively. Because of this noble experiment, a famously beautiful city park was transformed into a dreadful slum. There were piles of used needles and blood-stained cotton balls stacked under the linden trees. Fortunately, the citizens of Zurich didn't take the outrage lying down. They forced the Swiss government to reverse its wrong-headed policy. In America, legalization would be even worse for at least two reasons: the sheer numbers of potential users in our growing population, and the simple fact that users do not like to do drugs alone. Users want company so badly, they will share their drugs, illegal, illegal, expensive or free. If you think it's easy for your kids to get their hands on cigarettes and booze now, and it is, just wait until the day some town or state makes the mistake of legalizing heroin, coke, and pot. It would be a nightmare. Well, there's another approach that gets a lot of attention but not enough thought. Would spending federal dollars to open thousands of drug rehab centers cure the problem? No. Hold that thought. No. Backup stats. When the think tank RAND Corporation organized a massive study of drug rehab, the results were dismal. Only 13% of hardcore cocaine abusers stayed clean after they were released from rehab. Experts estimate that anywhere from 60 to 80% of drug addicts want nothing to do with rehab programs. Hint, that's what addict means. The problem with well-meaning do-gooders who push for expensive rehab programs is that they aren't looking closely at the reality of drug use. Only a tiny minority are motivated to enter rehab, and motivation is the key. Without it, no therapy will work. Every drug counselor will tell you that. The true addict has turned away from all personal and social responsibility. Is the baby crying? Get high and you won't hear it. Have you lost your job for being out of it most of the time? Now you can stay out of it all the time. That's the addict's way of thinking. Life is lived for the purpose of getting high. The truth is obvious. The only solution to the drug problem in America is to deal directly with users as the law requires. As you probably know, the courts have ruled that the authorities have the right to drug test everyone who is arrested, no matter what the reason. Why? Because the state has a right and probably an obligation to know the physical condition of people taken into custody. You probably don't hear many good things about the state of Alabama in today's media, but a new program there points the way to a saner future. All prisoners are now tested as soon as they're booked in Alabama. The majority, no surprise, have drugs or alcohol in their blood. The test results are passed along to the courts. All convicted suspects are given a choice: forced drug rehab in a prison drug facility, or a longer sentence with the general prison population. More than 90% opt for rehab. Hundreds of pages of statistics on this new program already prove its unusual effectiveness. Of the 5,000 participants so far, twice as many criminals stay off drugs upon release than those without rehab. For years after release, the ex-cons must submit to regular drug testing, and that's a key. But wait a minute. How does this rehab program differ from the rehab centers that our tax dollars could set up by the thousands? The Alabama program works so well because of three factors. First, the hardcore drug customers forcibly taken off the street and kept away from the drug-using environment. That cuts down the temptation. Second, the close monitoring after release provides a strong incentive to keep clean. If you test positive for drugs, you're hauled back to prison rehab, no exceptions. Third, this program takes customers by the bushel away from the local pusher man. It attacks profit in the drug marketplace. What's the lesson here? It's that the Fed should shift the billions in the drug war budget to coerced drug treatment in all 50 states. Backup stats. Some 7 million Americans buy a total of 331 tons of cocaine each year, according to the RAND Corporation. Take half of these users off the streets and place them in forced rehab, and the U.S. coke market would collapse. Bulletin. To support this new approach, prosecutors and judges should ensure that all pushers get slammed with big-time mandatory prison sentences. That would put the risk-reward ratio of dealing squarely against these merchants of death. How does forced rehab work? Well, it should be humane. The point is to give the drug-addicted criminal a fighting chance to succeed in society upon release. This means psychiatric drug counseling, educational classes, job training, and job placement. That's a sensible and fair formula for giving drug-addicted criminals a leg up on leading a productive life. Sound rehab cleans up the users, tries to get to the source of their emotional problems, and provides them with the tools to succeed. This is good, smart policy, but it won't work if it isn't tough. If the release addict commits another crime and is returned to the system, the second time around should be much stricter. Such criminals should be given rehab again, but in a more intense setting. They should have to work long hours in addition to their treatment. Their sentences should be doubled. After all, society has already invested a lot of time and money in their recovery, and they blew it. The taxpayers who foot the bills are owed a no-nonsense, carrot-and-stick approach to repeat offenders. Am I wrong? Well, some people think so. They complain that forced drug rehab is inherently racist because it would affect more blacks than whites. This is absolute nonsense. What's racist about investing billions of federal dollars in helping the drug-addicted criminal? Many of them are poor and badly educated. Let's get them a second chance to succeed in our competitive society. If more members of minority groups are addicted, then more members of minority groups are going to benefit. Forced drug rehab is an opportunity, not a punishment. Racism, if we think about it for a minute, is allowing the drug problem to fester and grow in minority communities that are falling further away every day from the American dream. Racism is expecting less responsibility from minorities than from the rest of society. Then there's the disease excuse. It goes like this. Drug addiction is a disease, so society has no right to punish addicts for their illness. Well, this kind of ridiculous argument makes me ill. We need to stop feeling sorry for people who careen out of control and begin to impose sanctions on them. What do the experts say? They disagree. You'll find just as many researchers arguing that drug addiction and alcoholism are not diseases as the reverse. I don't know who's right, but I do know this. Millions of former addicts and alcoholics have proved that substance abuse can be conquered by the abuser. People can stop drinking and drugging. They cannot stop prostate cancer or a brain tumor by just saying no. Those are diseases. Oh, and one more thing. As long as addictions are considered to be diseases, then physicians, counselors, and administrators of rehab centers are going to be able to claim reimbursement from insurance companies. And government grants will fund existing and new programs. But if addiction is considered to be a psychological weakness, not a disease, then the flow of corporate and government checks dries up. Okay, If I can figure out that no attack upon our national drug problem is going to work as well as the Alabama solution of forced rehab for addicted criminals in prison, why can't the federal government get the picture? Because of the realities of power and class that we talked about earlier. Washington's rich and powerful don't care about the drug problem in American life because it doesn't impact their lives. What nationally known politician lives down the street from an openly functioning drug bazaar like the little people in parts of Harlem or South Central LA, or Chicago's South Side for that matter? I don't know any. Which media mogul or millionaire lobbyist has a five-year-old kid who can explain crack slang to him because it's used all the time in the neighborhood? Not one. Well, you can bet I've tried to knock some sense into the powers that be. On the O'Reilly Factor, I've debated the use of coerced prison rehab with some of the biggest political names in the country, and so far, no one has poked a hole in the idea of forced rehab yet, because they can't. They know the truth. Nothing else is working. Bulletin. The government could bring the drug problem under control within the next 2 years by providing block grant monies to states for coerced drug rehab. That's an amazing statement, but it's true. Yet it is not going to happen because the D.C. Beltway establishment could not care less about this issue. Consider how important it would be to get even half the nation's drug addicts into forced prison rehab. Crime would fall dramatically. The AIDS infection rate would drop. Fewer children would suffer abuse. And all of us would see our insurance rates go down. As the drug dealers are driven out of business, inner-city neighborhoods would become more livable overnight. Children going to school would no longer have to walk around junkies nodding out on the sidewalk. I can cite 20 more examples, but you get the picture. Somehow, we've got to make this happen. I believe it. I hope you believe it. And maybe if we keep at it, we can make the big boys in D.C. believe it. Treating alcoholism is a different problem. I don't know any effective solution. You can't resort to coerced treatment because booze is legal. That means that alcoholics can emotionally damage their families and drink themselves to death, but society can do nothing but watch unless there's physical abuse or drunk driving. Backup stats. Lest we get jaded, the death toll from drunk driving accidents in 1998 was 16,189 children, women, and men. Each one of them was a uniquely individual human being. Every year, according to government estimates, drunk driving crashes cost more than $45 billion, not counting lost wages, physical therapy, and rehabilitation. Meantime, the alcoholic can choose from two kinds of messages. On TV and in print, there are campaigns to warn about the dangers of abusing alcohol. But the same media outlets also provide glamorous or clever advertisements. Will the alcoholic put down the glass because of a Mothers Against Drunk Driving spot or refill it because of the images of beautiful people in beautiful places having an ad man's fantasy of the good life? You know the answer. Alcoholics have heard the message they want to hear since Noah invented viniculture and made a fool of himself by getting drunk and passing out in front of his family. Still, the drug addict takes drugs for only one reason: to get high. The vast majority of Americans who drink are able to do so responsibly without crossing the line to intoxication. That's a significant difference. It also shows that society is not entirely hypocritical by legalizing booze but not narcotics. But no one can argue that you need alcohol any more than you need drugs. You'll have a better life if you avoid both entirely. The whole intoxication thing is a minus for all of us. From broken health to broken friendships, alcohol and drugs are not worth the hassle. Even a so-called minor drug like marijuana has a negative impact. It erodes discipline and is toxic to the body. More kids are in pot rehab than are in alcohol rehab. If I sound like I'm from the land of Oz, so be it. The Factor is here to tell you the straight story. Walk away from the seductive rites of inebriation and your odds of succeeding in America will soar. Note to Bill Richardson, Secretary of the Department of Energy, you found out what? The Chinese have been looting some of America's most prized nuclear secrets for more than a decade? But I gotta admit it, you took quick action. Your new DOE job guidelines instruct all employees to report any romantic involvement with a person from a country that's developing nuclear weaponry. So to keep their private lives private, your employees better date someone from Cameroon or Italy rather than Pakistan or Israel. This is ridiculous, Bill. Your DOE guidelines are DOA, By the way, instead of scrutinizing the love lives of those in your charge, you might call up former Secretary of Energy Hazel O'Leary and ask her why she gutted security at all of our nuclear facilities. Then call up Attorney General Janet Reno and ask her why she denied a wiretap on Wenho Lee's hot computer. Do these things, Bill, and you'd be doing your job. Like Bill Richardson, most of us have to work for a living. Most of us hate something about our jobs, beginning with our bosses. Most of us don't think our work is appreciated or fairly compensated. That's what we tell the pollsters anyway, and yet, quite a few of us are not planning to retire. Ever. I guess that means that having a job and doing it well, even when you get teed off or feel exploited, is an important part of life. We all want to make things or make things happen. You don't have to work in the Department of Energy to deal with baloney, bull, and bilge. There are always going to be hassles wherever you get a job, even if you work at home. Viewer timeouts. Hey, you probably deal with only one supervisor and some coworkers, right? Not me. I got hundreds of thousands of supervisors, the viewing public. Last August, on an evening picked at random, here are job evaluations phoned in by some of my supervisors. 8:10 p.m. This is about O'Reilly. I'm upset because he doesn't know how the intelligence community works. I think he should be jailed for treason. 8:24 p.m. I normally watch Fox News, but not when O'Reilly's on. He is obnoxious and disrespectful to our great president. Please take him off immediately. 8:40 p.m. I can't take this O'Reilly. I think he's a Nazi. 8:52 p.m. Doesn't Fox have anyone else who can do this O'Reilly show? He's the most obnoxious guy I've ever seen on TV. I'm switching to CNN. 9 p.m. I just finished watching an hour of O'Reilly. I demand to talk with his superior right now. And you thought you had a hard day at the office. How do I deal with these reactions? Like Harry Truman. I choose to be in this particular kitchen. I like being in this kitchen. And I've learned throughout my career how to take the heat. I had to because I lead the league in dumb on-the-job strategies and unbelievably foolish maneuvers. I recount them here as a warning. Learn from my mistakes. Do not try this at work. I began working at age 11, not because I was born with a work ethic and not because I was ambitious. I had a strict father who kept a tight grip on his wallet. So my work life began as most do because I wanted money. I started out cutting lawns, babysitting, and hunting down lost golf balls to resell them. My first real job was behind the counter at a Carvel ice cream store one summer, and it was great. A buck an hour plus all the ice cream I could swallow, which was quite a bit. But this was the 1960s, when a dollar an hour was not going to get me to Woodstock. The next summer, I struck out on my own and began a house painting business with some of my thug friends. That gave me my first useful job lesson. Working for yourself is a big advantage if you are willing to work hard, and I was. My friends and I made a great team. Some weeks we cleared as much as $200 each. My father was delirious with joy. I was never going to meet him at the front door asking for cash. Ridiculous note. We teenage capitalists never turn down any good honest work. I guess that's why I'm surprised that Monica Lewinsky turned down a $480,000 job offer from an Italian designer. All she had to do was walk back and forth on a fashion runway in Milan, modeling a few of his two-piece outsized bathing suits. Miss Lewinsky found the gig inappropriate. How nice that propriety has become an option for her. As I've mentioned, I taught high school after graduating from Marist College. The pay was $5,000 a year at a Catholic school whose philosophy was, poverty is good because Jesus was poor. Unfortunately, poverty was one of the few things Jesus and I had in common. I liked being a teacher. I felt I helped some students and kept the rest awake. I was always prepared for class because I didn't want to waste their time or mine. But the school's corrupt dictator of a principal took a different approach. He was perfect for the totalitarian system, that is American education, laying down foolish rules and ignoring important problems. I mocked him at faculty meetings, but that kind of behavior is a dead end. Nothing was going to change. He had no respect for students or teachers. He just wanted to keep a lid on things. So I bailed out and went to Boston University for my master's in broadcast journalism. Good training, but no guaranteed meal ticket. My first TV job was at a tiny station, WNEP-TV, in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and I was glad to get it. After driving down from Boston for the interview, I appeared in the station manager's office wearing a powder blue sports jacket and double-knit slacks. Add the mid-70s hairstyle, and I looked like a barker at a strip club. But I was a shoo-in because I agreed to work for $150 a week. This was not smart. After taxes, my take-home pay was about $475 a month. Because there was a rental housing shortage in Scranton, my rent was $250 a month. And I needed to get a new wardrobe pronto to go before the camera and deliver the news with any hope of being taken seriously. Things were very tight. So I did a fairly stupid thing. After less than 2 weeks on the job, I complained. I should have waited at least a month, but it was okay. This was a family-owned station that patiently heard complaints and tried to be fair. The general manager, who was kind, came up with a plan. For an extra $20 a week, I would write gag lines for the station's Saturday evening monster movie program, Uncle Ted's Ghoul School. I signed right up. It was not long before Uncle Ted and I had some pretty fierce creative differences. An old Scrantonite who hosted a variety of local programs over decades, the 60-year-old Ted loved the sauce, and I'm not talking Chef Boyardee here. Ted was usually half in the bag during the telecasts, which were live, and mangled some of my best one-liners. Who cares? Well, let me tell you, you can get caught up in these things. Like Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis before their famous split, our relationship soon sank to the level of outright hostility. I got pretty steamed, and I took action that might have been a tad inappropriate. When a movie called Dracula's Daughter was scheduled, I arranged a local mortuary to send over a coffin in exchange for an on-air plug. Then I suggested to the director that Uncle Ted, who looked like a vampire without using makeup, do what vampires do. That is, emerge from a coffin to open his segment. Ted adamantly refused. I insisted, even though a technician told me Ted was claustrophobic. I called the general manager, who ordered Ted to go along with the skit. Cursing a blue streak, our host climbed into the coffin, and I locked it from the outside. When his live insert was cued during the commercial, he pushed with all his might. The lid stayed shut tight. The coffin rocked back and forth on live TV. The mic picked up Ted's muffled screams from inside. Laughing, I signaled the director to cut back to the movie. Everyone thought the whole thing was hilarious, except Uncle Ted. When the coffin lid was finally unlocked, he stormed off the set, vowing to kill me when I least expected it. I replaced him as MC that night, explaining to the amazed audience that he had accidentally been exposed to some garlic, but would return next week. He did, but I didn't. Nope, I wasn't axed as a news reporter, but my gag-writing career was history. Okay, the whole stunt was immature, but it was funny. Did I let it teach me anything about how to play well with others? No. I shed no tears for Uncle Ted. After 9 months at WNEP, an offer came from a station in Dallas. I left Scranton for the great American Southwest. And I hadn't seen anything yet. After the plain dealing of the folks at WNEP-TV, I was 26 going on 10 in the worldliness department. Suddenly, I was swimming among the sharks at WFAA-TV, a powerhouse station. It swarmed with ambitious, aggressive journalists battling each other under the thumb of an unsympathetic management. But I was not going to be knocked aside. I jumped right in and made every possible political mistake. Openly challenged the arrogant but successful news director, that was me. Blurt out stupid comments in the newsroom, me again and again. Mouth off to the producers on a daily basis. So what saved me from being thrown out into the street? Once again, my pay was low, less than $300 a week, so even pain in the ass O'Reilly was a bargain. And my work was good. It had to be. The honchos got back at me by torturing me with lousy assignments and mocking the hell out of me. But they had to put me on the air because I came through every time. Did I mention 26 going on 10? Well, that's the only explanation for what brought things to a head in Dallas. In a staff meeting, I criticized the decision to hire a new anchor woman. It's outrageous, I fumed. The room froze. See, I thought it was not sound news practice to bring aboard an untested anchor just because she was supposedly sleeping with one of the station honchos. Wrong, O'Reilly. I found out this happens all the time in the TV news industry. So I was suspended for 2 weeks for insubordination. I was shocked all over again. What insubordination? I had offered an honorable opinion, and I had offered it in the interest of giving the public a good newscast. Without freedom of speech, the managers and owners of a TV station would not be making money. That's the foundation of broadcast journalism. So where does a TV station get off suspending me or anybody for speaking freely? Then a strange thing happened. Jim Simon, at the time the news director for the radio side of WFAA, hired me to work for him during my suspension at double my salary. One of journalism's true believers, he knew I had been sandbagged, and he didn't like it. So things turned out well for me, despite my big ego and my big mouth. The TV management was humiliated, and from this I learned nothing. After 2 years, I left Dallas, still naive enough to believe that right can always overcome wrong. Next stop, KMGH-TV in Denver. Paul Thompson, my new news boss, liked my brash style, paid me well, and allowed me free rein to roam all over Colorado in search of stories. Thanks to his faith in me, I broke some big ones. But after a year, Thompson left for a better job. His replacement, Lucifer, the Prince of Darkness, did everything you'd expect from the King of Hell. I fought back and was in constant trouble. Are there 9 circles of hell? I was sent down to level 8 at least. Then, I swear, the Lord intervened, trumping Satan again. I was awarded an Emmy for best breaking news coverage for a story I did on an airline skyjacking in Denver. It takes a lot for a functionary to argue with an on-air Emmy. The award becomes part of the station's advertising and corporate image. Gnashing his teeth in private, the fiend news director got out of my face. But the backbiting continued in the offices of upper management. I had still not learned that you cannot challenge authority in the workplace without lining up some major forces to support you. Within a couple of months, I left Denver for the East Coast. An Emmy on the coffee table is a fine thing, but it doesn't beat getting respect from the people you break your back for. After I briefly anchored the news in Hartford, Connecticut, CBS offered me a job in New York City, a huge step up the career ladder. Viewer timeout. Why did people keep hiring me? Maybe this viewer has the answer. Mr. O, I find you smug and annoying. I believe you have a personal bias regarding a wide variety of issues. However, for reasons I cannot readily explain, these traits seem to increase my enjoyment of your program. Zeke U, Leavenworth, Kansas. At this point, I had worked at 4 different TV stations in 5 years, so of course I was experienced enough now to operate wisely within a large bureaucracy. Yeah, and Al Sharpton cares for all Americans. I was about as perceptive as a telephone pole. Besides, I had no stomach for playing the corporate game. I relished my defiance of corrupt authority and my doomed crusades for justice in the newsroom. So I marched down the halls of CBS like Clint Eastwood. This was the same Dirty Harry attitude that had already got me in so much trouble in 3 different time zones. I was completely out of my mind. Celebrity sighting. The analogy to Eastwood is deliberate. I admired the man and the actor. He's the same height as I am, came from a working-class background, and made it on his own, rising from his movie debut in Revenge of the Creature to become the most successful movie star in the world. He came to Denver to make one of those dopey monkey flicks with his girlfriend at the time, Sandra Locke. Naturally, he was surrounded by a phalanx of bodyguards, but your young, intrepid reporter was determined to get an interview. I found out where he was staying, bribed the doorman for Clint's room number, and knocked on the door at 9:30 in the morning. A bleary-eyed Clint opened his door wearing a bathrobe and pinned me with that patented squinty-eyed look. The camera was rolling, and I cheerfully welcomed him to Denver. In his famous raspy voice, he said, "Why don't you guys take a hike?" Shameless, I explained how an interview with me would be great for his career. Eastwood apparently found that amusing and said, "Okay, kid, give me 15 minutes and I'll talk to you." Back at the station, my colleagues were stunned by this coup. Clint won greatest guy status in my eyes. It was 3 years later that I imitated his walk into CBS. Bulletin. I repeat, do not do what I did in the workplace. It's not worth it. I prospered in the world of TV news, but it's a miracle, believe me. I made my life 1,000 times harder than it had to be. Am I finally wiser? Well, maybe just a better strategist. Now I go into corporate combat only when there's no other option. I don't make the mistake of expecting fairness to be in play. I don't waste my own time and blood pressure in back and forth with pinheads. That's what my agents and lawyers are for, and they're brilliant at it. But enough of my resume. If you want more of the story of network newsroom intrigue in these turbulent times, it's in my novel, Those Who Trespass. Let's get off my job factor and back to yours. Here's the most important thing you need to know for success. Identify your true talents, then find out how to use them to make money. I don't care how old you are, it's never too late to use the gifts God gave you. Not many things are sadder or more damned annoying than someone who says, "I wish I had started my own woodworking business, written a book, moved to a farm, gone back to nursing school, etc., etc." Get off your duff and do it now. What keeps people from identifying their talents and using them? Laziness, insecurity, and lack of discipline. The cure for laziness is work. The cure for insecurity is light years more complicated, but it should not hold you back. The cure for lack of discipline is to learn to make yourself do what you do not want to do and do it on time. And you have to develop strong habits. Get punctual, bring energy and creativity to your work, and stay with a project until it's completed. And then double-check the results. These habits will make you indispensable. That's the key. Why will discipline make you stand out from everyone else on the job? Because the sad truth is that we live in an undisciplined age. The art of the excuse has been raised to Olympic caliber. In fact, there ought to be a new event in the Sydney Olympics called excuse making. The Irish would win the gold medal, a perfect 10, but the USA team would have a lock on the silver. Back in real life, though, excuses don't cut it. Your boss wants results, as do his and hers and his, all the way up to the chairman and the stockholders. Excuses are not results. Excuses are not money, and money counts. Sometimes excellence counts, and when it does, no excuse will paper over a half-assed job. I know discipline is not a user-friendly word, but you owe it to yourself to force yourself to do your job well. If the work is beyond your capabilities, face up to the fact and move on. If you have to work extra hours every night just to keep up, something is probably wrong. It's not how long you work, but how much you produce. If you don't or can't produce, the responsibility for that is yours alone. You don't want to descend into the world of weaseling and blaming others, and you must never take credit for work that is not yours, even if you're a movie producer. Does playing dirty ever work? The worst human being I've ever worked with prospers in network news, even as I speak, a true weaselette. She has never covered a news story, never been in the field, never faced a deadline, and never got behind the desk and appeared before a camera. Doesn't matter. Her skills don't need to be learned. They are ancient. She has accumulated vast power over scores of working reporters by kissing butt and spying on her coworkers. She can damage a career with a well-placed hiss, a comment. This particular creature instinctively hated my guts. Like most other people around the newsroom, I should have smiled and stayed out of her way. Naturally, I played right into her hands by openly despising her right back. In fact, I had to make a point of showing my disdain for her. Am I an idiot? The final answer, Regis, is yes. The disciplined person will take some time to figure out how to deal with such people. It's not that hard, really. Even the worst slime will respond to a little kindness, though you may have to grit your teeth and pass it along. Bulletin. Why do corporations allow the slime to do so much damage? After years of going head-to-head with them, I've finally reached enlightenment. Most of the suits want their employees frightened and on the defensive. The weasels help immensely with that. They provide information, much of it false, to the suits who are isolated in their upstairs offices. These weasels prosper because they are indispensable to many insecure corporate managers, unscrupulous political types on the make, and power-hungry entrepreneurs. This will never change. Don't waste as much time as I have thinking about these people. Accept them and dodge them. Nothing succeeds like success, according to the old saying. Well, here's another one. Nothing makes enemies like success. Once you learn to work hard, honestly and consistently, you are going to begin to succeed. That will make some people hate you. It's not your fault, and there's nothing you can do about it. Once again, don't copy my behavior. As I became more successful, a lot of less disciplined people in the business began to resent me. I had no patience for this. I told them to go scratch themselves or something like that. So I made droves of enemies, which was not smart. This is what I should have done and what you should do. Smile and wave goodbye as you rise above them in your career. Let them enjoy the view as you do. Never engage them in a personal way. There's nothing to be gained. Bulletin. If I can make it in America, you can too. It's as simple as that. Starting out, I had zero advantages, and I'm no genius. You already know that quite a few people think my personality is questionable at best. But I've always worked my butt off, haven't missed a day of work in 10 years, and am never satisfied until my work is better than what other people are putting out. I paid attention, tried not to make excuses when I flopped, and realized that the guaranteed route to moving up was making money for my bosses. That's the big picture, well, most of it. If I had been as disciplined in dealing with toxic coworkers and supervisors as I was in my work, God only knows what would have happened. And God is not talking at this point because his publicist doesn't think it's time. A final note about success on the job. It's not worth it if you have to achieve it dishonestly, and that includes screwing, literally and figuratively, coworkers. The vast majority of many brutal people I've known in TV news got fired or demoted after a period of time. Call it karma. Now, I'm no Bible thumper, but I do believe, as Jesus said, that gaining the whole world is not worth losing your soul. Or, if you don't believe in the soul, it's not worth the loss of your peace of mind or self-respect, unless you have no conscience. And if you do have no conscience, you're one of the unluckiest people alive. I mean it. A conscience gets in the way when we want to violate our personal moral code. But a conscience makes sure that in the workplace we work hard, keep it honest, and don't kiss up. There is dignity in honesty. In the long run, your dignity is much more important than your salary, bonuses, and stock options. What you do for others on the job is just as important as what you do for yourself. Are you bringing in big bucks? Good for you. That's all the more reason to wave at a school teacher or a cop on the beat or an elder care nurse when you see one. Their banker probably doesn't give them much respect. We should. Yes, we're back to money. And you have to be realistic on that subject. As I said before, most American families earn less than $50,000 a year. Before deductions, the feds in the state will take about $22,500 in taxes. Then there are sales taxes, property taxes, gasoline taxes, user fees, license fees, and on and on and on. In our tax culture, the wage earner shoulders an enormous burden. As I said earlier, the American system wants you to have enough money to spend regularly, but not enough to become financially independent and call your own shots. Employers and government bureaucrats can hold on to their power only as long as most Americans live from paycheck to paycheck. And politicians, by scaring voters with talk of Social Security and Medicaid aid shortfalls, are able to raise taxes again and again. Bulletin. In the 21st century, we pay more in taxes than any other American citizen since World War II. That is, workers do. If you've inherited wealth, your advisors have figured out how to slash your tax burden with tax-free bonds, trusts, corporations, and other tax-advantaged vehicles. No, it's the wage earners who foot the tax bill. The highest wage earners pay 75% of all U.S. income tax, and many in government would like to raise that rate and amass even more power. I thought the American way was to encourage hard-earned success, not penalize it. Wrong again, O'Reilly, you dope. So you have to prop your eyes wide open on the money issue when you're starting your career. If you opt for security, say by joining a union or working in a small business or taking a job in the public sector, odds are that you will reach your salary cap early on. Even out in the business world, unless you are uniquely talented or a hell of a salesperson, it is nearly impossible to get rich working for someone else. And doctors and lawyers who could once count on bringing in the dough are no longer guaranteed an upper middle class life. The government has cut back payments for medical service, and the competition is fierce. Specialists make the big money now, but who knows what the future holds for them, as insurers, federal bureaucrats, and HMOs try to cut costs. I may surprise you here, but I truly believe that money is not what we Americans should be focusing on. Of course, we need it, but enjoying a job is worth plenty, too. If you look forward to going to work when you wake up in the morning, you are a success, no matter what your job description. Do you envy the guys and gals with the huge houses out in the suburbs? How about their 2- and 3-hour commutes? And how about the big nuts of taxes, mortgages, private school fees, and all the rest that require them to keep their heads down and play the corporate games, losing their dignity so they won't lose their mock tutor homes? Sometimes having money costs too much. Who knew that writing dopey jokes for Uncle Ted's Ghoul School would lead anywhere? I didn't, but I did know that I was never going to give up. I survived, and I've enjoyed it, weaselettes and all. Your life, too, will unfold in ways you can never imagine if you keep hammering away at your dream with discipline, talent, and goodwill. Dance around the bastards, never forget your allies, and trust yourself above all. Note to Evander Holyfield. Did you understand what the recent award meant, the one from the National Fatherhood Initiative, naming you a Father of the Year? I don't think so, Evander. I mean, it wasn't given for fathering 5 children by 4 women you didn't get around to marrying. That's not what they meant by initiative. This national fatherhood group might want to get an IQ. Here, this program makes a major shift in focus. We go from the world outside back to your private life. We're going to think about an ongoing part of daily living, personal relationships. If we don't handle them effectively, we can't have a successful life in modern-day America. What comes next are just some O'Reilly observations. Take them for what they're worth to you. If you don't like them, dump them. Let's begin with parents and with some common sense. Forget all the bad stuff they did to you when you were a kid. Wipe it out. Zero. Nada. But, you say, they blah, 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 blah. So what? None of this ancient history should matter to you today. Beginning right now, here's what you have to do. Face your problems on your own. Deal with the cards you've been dealt. It's too late for retooling. You're a completed work. What happened, happened. Get it? Should you forgive your parents? You'd be better off if you could. If you can't forgive them, then drop the grudges. Otherwise, you're just looking for revenge, and that keeps you from enjoying life in the present. Remember, your parents had to compete with changes in the media and other parts of society that have only become harder to fight. The rise of TV started the decline of parental status in America. Once the two began lighting up the nation's living rooms in the early 1950s, parents made a bargain with the devil. Here was a cheap, easy way to keep the kids quiet. The working dad didn't come home to a lot of chatter at the dinner table. The kids were eating off the TV trays. American ingenuity at its best, or what? In the den or living room. And they didn't require a hot meal made from scratch thanks to the invention of the Swanson TV dinner. As parents stayed in the next room for quality time with each other or whatever, the kids found much better parents on TV. There was Ozzie Nelson, who kicked my dad's butt all over the yard. He was funny and always understanding, and seemed to have enough in his wallet when it mattered. Back in my teen years, Shirley, matriarch of the Partridge family, was pretty, perky, extra nice, well-dressed, and freshly made up. And she played in a rock band. Sorry, Mom. Kids watch because their parents had given in to the media. That abdication of responsibility started a chain reaction of events that put pressure on parents to live up to a scriptwriter's ideal. Here's how it worked. Parents gave up part of their job to TV. TV brought in pretty pictures of perfect family life, and the kids, glued to this mental bubblegum, began having unreasonable expectations of their own unscripted parents. TV, according to one writer, fed a sense of generational superiority in the kids who watched it. I know exactly what he means, and so do you. I expected only one thing from my father: leave me alive to celebrate my next birthday. Today's kids expect much more, demand it even. Parents must have perfect attendance at games, dance recitals, you name it. They have to understand their kids' pain in wanting what other kids have, and that means making enough money to keep their own kids happy. They're supposed to be kind and patient in the face of a kid's barbaric fits and acting out. Satisfying the desires of children can be an overwhelming task. Worse, it can distract parents from paying attention to the really important parental duties, teaching discipline, morality, and the truth about how the world works. Then, almost as important, there's encouraging your kids' imagination and explaining to them the art of conversation and the joy of thinking. I well remember all of the parents in my neighborhood when I was growing up. Except for a couple of actual maniacs, they were pretty much the same. The exceptions, who were booze hounds or had violent tempers, were an embarrassment to everyone. I stayed away from them, and so did their own children if they could. I've already explained my parents' blue-collar backgrounds and their college educations. When it came to raising my sister and me, background won out over newfangled education every time. Just like their parents, they believed in spare the rod, spoil the child, and children should be seen, not heard. And we heard almost every night about the children starving in Korea. Boy, did they starve. Today, I guess, it's Kosovo or Chechnya. But the lesson's the same, and it's a good one. You are one lucky kid, so shut up and eat. My father, particularly, would have won praise from Mussolini for his, child-rearing practices. One more time and you'll be sorry was not an empty threat. In our house, there were never any timeouts, but plenty of knockouts. Sorry, I guess I'm getting carried away with nostalgia. To be fair, there were really more like TKOs. My parents and their friends were not wicked, cruel, abusive, or unfeeling, just the opposite on all counts. The thing is, they were afraid. I didn't know that then, and I probably wouldn't have cared or understood, but it's clear to me now. Growing up in the depths of a worldwide depression drilled fear into them. They'd seen banks fail, families get evicted, factories close down, soup kitchens open. Then came the most terrifying war in history. My father was a naval officer who was given major responsibility in the American occupation of Japan. Yet when he returned home, he took a low-level accountant's job at a major oil company and never moved up or left for another challenge, even though he hated every minute of his job. He did not express himself through his work. He was simply unhappy. He was stuck, and so were most of the other parents in my neighborhood. It's hard for later generations to understand, but this was not a rare thing for people my father's age. He was afraid, that's all. He was afraid to take a chance. Talented, educated, he could have done big things with his life except for that one dominant fear, that he would make a mistake and fall forever into unemployment. So he stayed where he was and took the crap that was dished out there. His fear also shaped the way he ran his family. When we become parents, the first thing most of us say is that we won't make the same mistakes our folks made. That's why today's kids have more lip than the kids I grew up with. I can't imagine defying my father in his presence. When I see so many kids disobeying their parents in public places today, or even hitting them, I laugh out loud. If I had acted anything like that, I would have ended up in traction. Would the neighbors complain? Would the cops be called? No. The neighbors would tell their kids to take a lesson from my condition, and the cops would have treated my dad to a beer. This just in, discipline is a symbol of caring to a child. He needs guidance. If there is love, there is no such thing as being too tough with a child. A parent must also not be afraid to hang himself. If you've never been hated by your children, you have never been a parent. Betty Davis in The Lonely Life, 1962. Did I take my father's discipline with a cheerful heart? Are you crazy? There were times when my heart was black with the urge for revenge. I thought I hated him, although it was really frustration. It didn't seem fair to get felony punishments for such misdemeanors as knocking over the neighbor's garbage cans or yawning while I was serving mass as an altar boy. These were trivial offenses, but no matter how angry I got, I never tried to get back at my father. I'm proud of that. My parents deserved respect. Most parents do. That doesn't mean that any kid should take abuse. Once you finish high school, you should leave such toxic parents as alcoholics, drug abusers, sex abusers, and so on. Just hit the road. Don't even think of trying to even the score. It's courageous and dignified to walk away without trying to strike back. If a parent abandons you, shows jealousy toward you, or has no real interest in your welfare, disengage. Don't descend to his or her level. You'll be a better person. My parents certainly did not fit these descriptions, though neither of them had sophisticated parenting skills. They knew enough to know that. As far as they were concerned, Dr. Spock was full of it. They didn't know terms like self-esteem, playdates, or acting out. They wanted us to become good citizens who could support ourselves someday. Many of you, I bet, had parents similar to mine. They made loads of mistakes, no question about it, but they tried to do the right thing. If they didn't teach me certain life skills, that's because no one had ever passed along those skills to them. No one taught us how to think, how to deal effectively with adversity, or even the basics of behaving well in polite society. But as you can guess from the beginnings of this discussion, I long ago forgave my parents for not being as sophisticated and understanding as the Nelsons, the Andersons of Father Knows Best, and Bill Cosby's Huxtable family. I see that I've talked so much about parental discipline that I've skewed the picture. I wasn't a fiend all the time, so I wasn't punished all the time either. My father was a lively man with a good sense of humor. He wasn't heartless, and he wasn't stupid about the human heart. That's what this next little story shows, I think. Since my father commuted with his carpool to the city around 6:30 in the morning and didn't get home till about 7 at night, he missed most of my ball games in the Central Nassau Little League. That was fine with me. The guys in my neighborhood despised the Little League dads who showed up at every game and whined because their sons weren't getting enough playing time. They were ridiculous, and sometimes the apple didn't fall far from the tree.